What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and joining me today for the 125th minute of Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus is a man who thinks that one of the most important things you need to know about him is that he has a tattoo of Elliot Gould smoking. But I also think that he's the perfect man to come and talk about this particular minute from a few words from his incredible piece. He's a staff writer for Brightwall Darkroom, one of the best publications, film publications online. And he wrote a piece on Sam Peckinpah's Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. And two lines really resonate with me. The first one was his description of a room, and I quote, "The room is a gaudy piss-yellow tableau of junk drawer 70 chic," which was one of the most fabulous word pictures I could have hoped for. And the other was him talking about the great Sam Peckinpah, a huge influence on the auteur behind this masterpiece, Michael Mann, where he says that Peckinpah's films lament the old-fashioned codes of masculinity and increasingly fraught inquiries into them. Ladies and gentlemen, staff writer for Brightwall Darkroom and also LA correspondent for Cinephilia and Beyond, Travis Woods, welcome to One Heat Minute.
Well, thank you for having me. And like, hell, forget heat. Let's just talk about what a great writer I am some more. That was very flattering. I wasn't expecting that.
Well,
let's just roll with that for a bit.
Oh, well, let's get talking. Well, look, this is, you know, I'm a very lucky person as a host of this show that so many incredible people out there in the world and talented writers and film critics and whatnot love this movie. And I feel like this is the critical mass that we need to revitalize. As we're recording, we've just gone past the Oscars, and I put one tweet out on the day and just said, just as a reminder, in 1996, Heat had no Oscar nominations. An undeniable masterpiece, nearly 25 years later, zero. None. Nada. Zip. A travesty.
What was the best picture in 96? Or for the 96 Oscars? What won?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't. I'm just like, it doesn't matter. So welcome, sir. Thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very excited because I am a humongous Heat nerd and a Michael Mann nerd in general.
Yes.
And as we were talking pre-show, This is insane. This is there should be like a DSM-5 entry for what you are doing. Like this is insane. But it's wonderful because, as you said, not that like Heat is a forgotten movie. Obviously, everybody knows Heat. Everybody loves Heat. But what I think is one of the things I think is so cool about this is one of those movies that people who love it, they've seen it like 500 times. You know, if it's on TV, it's the movie that you sit down on the couch. You're like, I'm sorry, I can't go out now. Heat's on. It's a movie that, you know, if it's playing at a repertory theater where you live, you don't care that it's 3 hours with no intermission. You're going to sit down. You're going to sit in the theater. You're going to watch it. It is one of those movies we've all – if anyone's listening to this podcast, it's a movie they have watched a lot and love. But what I love – what I think is so interesting about this podcast is how it recontextualizes the movie, in that with every single minute of this film, we are – as listeners, we are listening, or we are seeing the film through all these different new sets of eyes.
Yes.
And things that we never would have noticed before, things we never would have picked up on before, we're now noticing, or even things we disagree with. And I think that's amazing. And again, it's insane, but it's amazing.
That's the thing that keeps me energized too. That's why I like having, that's one of the great joys of having multiple guests. And there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of minute podcasts, and it's debatable on certain films that I think deserve the minute by minute breakdown. There are definitely some amazing ones out there. You know, there's, a movie like Goodfellas or Where It All Started. I think Star Wars Minute was the very first one that sort of kicked off the cascade. It's like, there are some seminal movies that are out there, but I just think this movie stands a test of time to do that. And also stands the additional layer of just having great, unique people bringing their takes to it. Because as you said, you and I can attest, we've watched this movie countless times. Like I couldn't give you a count of how many times I've now seen this movie, and especially with this show, seeing sections of the movie in a rotating, you know, 20 or 30 minutes just to keep myself abreast of, you know, thematic things that are happening, keeping an eye on different characters that I'm talking about. And every time someone comes on the show, I'm invariably encounter a perspective that I just hadn't thought about before. And so it's super exciting to be like, I've now watched this movie more than 200 times easily, and I'm now like 120 episodes, 125 episodes into the show, and I'm getting new perspectives. It's really great.
Jeez. And well, you know, at least you picked a short movie too. So yeah, I want to get to this. One other thing, are you, I don't mean to just turn this into a Blake interview, but like, are you bored with Heat yet? I was thinking about this today. Like, you know, I watched Heat like last month, and then I watched it again this week because I was going to be on the show. And before I put it on today, I was just kind of like, God, is this going to be boring? I mean, I just watched this, and it wasn't, and I loved it, but I'm assuming you've seen it so many more times. Like, are you ever just bored? Are you like Vincent and Justine, where the thrill's kind of just not there anymore?
The goddamn chicken. No, I'm not. And this is, I genuinely am not, because I just get excited. But to be fair, one thing I would say to folk is I don't watch the whole movie at the moment. It's sort of sporadically. Like every week when I prepare for the show, I don't spend 3 hours watching the movie again. I usually watch 30 minutes in a rotation. Let's just say 30 minutes in a rotation. So in preparation for this minute, I usually just throw it on like 15 minutes before, just to sort of catch up where I am. Watch the corresponding minutes that I'm going to talk about for like yourself or other shows that are planned. And then I sort of watch it and do that. So I'm not bored. I kind of dive back in, and it's like, I don't know any other way to describe it other than like, have you ever had a favorite novel that you've read so many times and dog-eared the pages so many times that you can pick up any page and start reading and you're okay with it? Like I can literally, any entry point into this movie, whether it's a minute before this, for half an hour or any point, I feel like I'm experiencing it in a weird way that's more like a novel, the intimacy of a novel, where you've just literally, you know, if my Blu-ray could tell a story of how many times it's been watched, like I broke a Blu-ray, I ran it to death, and then I had to buy the same one again. So, no, I'm not bored. I'm thrilled, but it makes me a much more discerning character, I guess, as a film critic and as a film consumer, of like, the value of every single minute. And when I feel like waste, I think if anything, it's made me feel wasted minutes lot more in lesser movies or movies that have got that aren't as aware and as innately sort of communicative with their audience about the emotional trajectory of what they want you to be on. So as soon as you feel like, I feel like it's made me a worse bad movie watcher, because as soon as it's a bad, I'm just like, oh, this is God, this is grating. Yeah. But you know, it's no, not bored yet. I'm excited. You talked about a repertory theater in Australia. There's a little one in a Sydney, in a eastern suburb of Sydney called Randwick Ritz, a cool little repertory theater. And in a couple of weeks, in Australia, they're playing Heat on 35 mil for 2 days. They're going, doing a Friday session and a Sunday session. And, I was telling my friends about it. I said, I'm going to go along and see it. And one of my friends goes, who are you kidding? You're going to go see it twice. And they're right. I am. I know it is, but it's also, but also the experience of watching the exact version that we're talking through today, not the director's definitive edition, like a 35 mil print of the original theatrical release of Heat on the big screen with an audience, is thrilling, because it's a different, I think it plays so different with an audience, you know.
Yeah, and, it does, you know. I saw it. I saw it with my old man the week it came out in December. It was like right before Christmas, so like 95, and I was way too young. I was 13, and I was terrified. And then I've seen it a couple more times in repertory theaters, like the New Beverly here in LA. And it is a blast to watch it with an audience, as your eardrums are just being hammered by the gunfire. And just smothered by it. And it is a blast to watch with, especially there's been, I was at one screening where whoever was doing a Q&A for it asked the audience if there were people who hadn't seen it before. And, there were a good number of hands that were thrown up that hadn't seen it. And I tried to clock each one of them and keep my eyes on those people during the movie.
Yes.
And all the twists and turns. And like whenever like some Wayne Gros shit would go down, or especially the big chase, the confrontation at LAX at the end, just seeing people moan and grab their fists and stuff that I don't normally see people do in theaters anymore. It was great to see so long after the movie had come out, see people still reacting to it like that in such a fresh way.
Yeah, I just don't think people realize how funny Al Pacino is in this movie. Like, it's a misunderstood performance. I honestly, it's a pressure relief. I saw the director's definitive edition last year in Australia. There was a little thing called the American Essentials Film Festival, and they did an LA, like they did a profile, like a little part of their program was LA films, great LA films. I think they had LA Confidential, Chinatown, Collateral was on the list as well, I believe, and Heat. And I just remember like the tension and the intensity of this thing. And then you hear Vincent say something, and he eases the pressure of the mounting pressure of the screen and the sound in that movie sometimes, and the mood, he just eases it and you laugh. And like, there were people like who hadn't seen the movie before just cackling, like it was like a great pressure release, but then, you know, building up to this confrontation. Look, we've got an amazing minute we've got to get into. I just was looking at the time, like, we've got to get into this minute because it's important.
Yeah, we are in trouble because I never shut up. So just fair warning and a pre-apology to listeners, like, I will not shut up once I start.
Look, this is good. This is good. Joe Lynch, hello. Speaking of not shutting up, one of our favorite guests on the show, Joe, has talked for the record, and I think Travis is going to go for it. So let's do it.
Really quick, what's the record? I got to know what I got to beat here.
Oh, I think one of the individual Joe Lynch minutes was like an hour and 10 on 1 minute.
Oh, Christ, I can crack that.
Oh, come on, Joe. We can do this. So this is the 125th minute, 2 hours and 4 minutes on the dial on the original theatrical version of Heat, for everyone listening. This is a moment that I just like to call... It's just a McKelty Williamson Ashley Judd showcase. And, you know, in talking to Travis about it, he made some astute observations, but I'll let him expand on around this movie is a collection of people being presented with choices. And there's not really a good choice. It's kind of layers of bad choices or layers of choices that compromise who they think they are. And this is one of those moments that is of such an elevated and personal nature that these are the parts of the movies that really scour out your soul in this movie. So really looking forward to you guys watching it. And it, again, an unbelievable Ashley Judd performance on show. So we're going to watch the 125th minute together, and then we're going to come back and we're going to unpack it for you.
Hello. So what now?
Well, he's right. Because you want out, this is out. You believe you have to betray Chris?
No shit.
That's right. You would have to. See, if you don't betray Chris, you victimize Dominic. Because he becomes an orphan when you go to prison as an accessory because you got no living parents to take him. So he ends up state-raised in foster homes, juvenile facilities. Then he steals a car. Then he winds up in gladiator academies like Gino and Tracy. Fucked for life. You know what happens, because you've been there. Dominic didn't get a chance yet to choose his life, but Chris did.
Jesus Christ. What a clean 60-second short story that minute is. That is so clean where that cuts off, where that ends. In this big, you know, novel of a film, that is such a perfect, perfect little snapshot and perfect little... If I can jump in, if you don't mind.
Go nuts. I love it.
Like I said, I'm gonna take up a lot of air here. When you first sent me this minute, I don't know if you remember, I was kind of bummed at first. Because I was like, well, that's not really like one of the iconic moments. I want Wayne Groh sucking air, you know, with a bullet wound in his chest. You know, spoiler warning. I want Nate telling Macaulay, you know, you're home free. You know, take it easy. This scene, what's in this scene? But then I went back and I watched it. And that's one of the great things about this podcast as well, is it does force you to look at some of these tinier moments and realize how necessary there are and how little fat is around the waist of this thing, despite being 165 minutes. And it might not be the flashiest scene, but it really is in a lot of ways. If Heat is a movie of extremes, you know, the law on one end and criminality on the other. This scene really is just a 1 minute microcosm of all of that.
Yes.
Where on one side, you've got the Heat literally bracing someone and doing what we've seen Pacino do the whole movie, which is absorb the flow of information around them and be able to case somebody and predict what their needs are and predict what their choices are going to have to be to get the jump on them and to box them in. And then on the other side of that, you have someone involved in criminality who, you know, he or she has made like a series of choices in their life that is now, it's backed them into a corner where they have to make this one kind of final existential choice that they think is, you know, they're either going to choose to save themselves or what they think will save themselves or not. And that's literally just, that's all of that pretentious shit that I'm talking about right now. That is all so cleanly just wedged into this little 60-second vignette in this Venice Boardwalk safe house. In Heat, and I think it's amazing.
I think it's amazing too. I think you're so right. The great thing is that we can project the more existential things about the minute. But what I love about this minute is the matter of fact delivery.
Oh,
The dance between these two characters. It's not there's no lack of familiarity with a situation like this. Charlene knows what the deal is, and Drucker knows equally what the deal is. And I just love the word play of do you think you'd have to betray Chris, and she's like, no shit, and he goes, yeah, that's right. Like, there's no hiding, there's no artifice.
Yeah,
that's right, you will have to betray him. Now let me unpack that for you, and then that's when he gets to drop that science at the end of that scene.
And it's so bluntly written that it almost feels like a screenwriter's note of what needs to be accomplished in the screen or on the screen and in the scene, what needs to be accomplished, as opposed to what the poetry that you're actually going to have your character espouse. But instead, he's just like, you think if you betray Chris, well, that's right, you are. Because if you don't betray Chris, you're going to victimize Dominic. It's just this very kind of bricklayer language of A plus A, B, C, D. But I love that because, you know, for one thing, he's on a clock.
Yes.
They've only got like 10 hours to get the wheels moving on this. So he's on a clock. He doesn't have time to play games.
And she's not a game player.
No.
The diagnoses between those two. I love as opposed to Marziano Hank Azaria's character, like when there's so many wonderful looks that Michael T. Williamson gives Judd here, that it just, the only way I can describe it, and he's in obviously one of Michael Mann's, one of the greatest boxing movies ever made. He's in Ali as Don King, but he's sizing up an opponent. He knows, he diagnoses immediately. She's not effing around. He knows where the weakness is, and it's Dominic. And he's got to exploit that. And he's got to let her know very straight up that with no massaging, no, you're going to make a choice because otherwise you victimize this kid and itemize here why.
Well, yeah, and he reads her, rightly so, as she's – and as we've seen throughout the film, she's a pragmatist. And he is able to, what's Kelso say early in the movie? This stuff just comes to you. It's broadcast in the air. You just have to know how to – you have to know how to grab it. I know how to grab it. And a lot of the – as we see Hannah do and as we're seeing Drucker do, he's grabbing that information from her, realizing that she's not a bullshitter. She's a pragmatist and she's a survivor. Mm. And most of all, as she said in her very first scene, she is about risk versus reward.
Yes.
And that is what – determines her decision making, risk versus reward. And I don't want to jump on someone else's minute, but as he's going to say in a moment to her when they have that three-way call with Hannah, he's just going to say, one answer, what's it going to be? And he doesn't have to be any prettier with her. And again, I'm going to cheat again and jump to this next minute, but when she has that great kind of hard-boiled noirish line, what else are you selling? And he's like, bunch of bullshit, but I don't have to sell this.
This shit sells itself.
Yes. And that's why, again, another reason why he doesn't have to doll this up. He knows that she's smart enough that he just has to lay this track and explain what Dominic's life is going to be, how, he's going to become institutionalized while you, Charlene, are in jail. He's going to steal a car. He's going to be thrown in to some place. He's going to be thrown into like Chino or Tracy, these gladiator academies where it's going to be rough. There's going to be a lot of violence. He'll probably have to join up with some Peckerwood crew just for protection, whether it's like Aryan Brotherhood or Nazi lowriders if he's like in Chino. And hell, he might not even grow up to become another Chris. He might grow up to be another Wayne Grow.
Mm.
Or something. And like he's... He's able to say that so dispassionately and matter-of-factly because he's seen this a million times. And we get the sense that Charlene has heard this story with other people and the people with the criminality that she is surrounded with. And I'm glad you brought that up, that just that amazing matter-of-fact delivery, because it's such a smart choice and smart performance. He doesn't need to do anything more, and he knows
you don't
that.
And a lesser movie would have him give like florid prose bullshit that doesn't really need to be in this scene. And I think that the fact that Charlene doesn't want to engage with him is all the more poignant because she knows what he's saying. She's already calculating it. And I think what he says here, which is good, like a good context setter for folk, is Charlene's seen this life, and I think that that's why she's so matter-of-fact with Chris, which is what you pointed out is earlier in the film. She knows it's risk versus reward. She's trying to get them and elevate them out of that life, because if he's taking the risk, she wants to continue to distance herself and Dominic away.
Yep.
And as Chris starts to spiral, what's her survival mechanism? She starts to go to another guy who seems legitimate in Nevada, businessman, successful. That's the guy she's having an affair with. She's thinking about the next move is an escape move, and her look back here, her frustration, is partially directed behind us as we're watching the film, because she's looking over at Marziano, probably jawing on with these cops who are actually standing in there being pissed off that this escape route has gone totally haywire on her, but also that she's trying to elevate Dominic out of that life. And yeah. And she's even given Chris the ultimatum. You can keep doing this shit, but Dominic goes with me.
And what am I doing in this rat bastard situation?
What are we doing in this rat bastard situation? Exactly. And so it's, I think that I think that choices to make scenes big or small, when they have such really perfectly pitched character understanding, it flows in such a different way that even if it seems like the dialogue is grubby, and when you read it on paper, it is grubby. It's not it's not finessed. It's grubby, but it's in this moment they don't need anything else. It's so great.
Yeah, it was actually even grubbier in the script. I don't know if you've seen the shooting script, but all of the stuff about gladiator academies and like the darkness of Dominic's future, it's basically like he goes to juvie and he steals a car and that's it.
Yeah.
And so, but this was pitch perfect. And what I quick question, as probably the foremost authoritative expert on Heat that there is, do you take into account, because Michael Mann's known for doing a lot of backstory, do you take in character backstory, unfilmed character backstory into account? Do you view that as canon, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, I think I know what you're saying, and I kind of do. I like that Mann. One of the things that, you know, I've written about it, but I haven't written about it a great deal, and I think you've kind of tapped into it, is people talk about method acting a lot, and I think if I had to qualify what I think Michael Mann's style is, it's method directing. Like, he has this imposition of method and character on individuals in the story. So for him, he'll impose with Charlene that she's probably been in jail. If not, she's had multiple partners who have been in jail. She's been around crime her whole life. Her complicit way that she interacts with it and being so matter of fact about risk and reward, there's a whole bunch of stuff there. And also, that survival mechanism comes with, you know, potentially a woman who's experienced violence in her life, like, you know, domestic violence. And so, like, talking specifically about Charlene, that's how I kind of read into that canon. Really interesting to note that Reed Coleman and Michael Mann later this year are going to be releasing the Heat prequel. So interesting to see how many characters actually feature and how much of that, you know, homework has done it. But that's, I kind of, in these little moments, you glean so much information, because I love in this moment that Drucker's already picked her apart. You know what this is like. You know this in prison and da-da-da, and Chris did this and Chris did that. And, you know, maybe these are the things that you can intuit about what happened in Chris's life, because he's literally probably reading a laundry list of what happened with Chris. You know, Chris stole a car, then he went to gladiator academies, and this is his life. And that's probably why it's even more. So, I do. I like to think about that stuff. And even in this show, they didn't realize that Neil had a Marine background until he had a Marine tattoo. And so it's just some of those times where you just glean this additional information after watching it. And you're like, oh my God, of course, that makes sense. That's where it all comes down to, the discipline.
Well, the reason that I asked that is, A, because, I wondered if this potential future for Dominic that Charlene's choice would engender, this dark road to Tracy, to Chino, to safecracking, to gang life, if that was a reflection, a knowing reflection of Chris's story on Drucker's behalf. But also something that I thought was kind of interesting is, you know, as much as this is a real kind of a real workout scene for McKelty Williamson, excuse me, and really gets to show what he can do well. I love Judd's performance in this scene, this performance of silence. And one of the things that always haunts me whenever I watch any of her scenes in the later half of the film is the backstory that she and Mann created for this character. Because she, you know, as you know, she did all these interviews with the wives and ex-wives and girlfriends of criminals. And she viewed the character, and this is the backstory that Mann gave her, that not only is she a pragmatist and a survivor, but why and how she became that way, and that, you know, she was probably a teenage prostitute and returned to that after she'd had Dominic, but when Chris was in prison, and that she was literally out there just on Van Nuys Boulevard, in the words of Michael Mann, turning 50 tricks a night, and then coming home and, you know, seeing her son, or in the very early days of after he got out of jail, coming home and seeing Chris. And that to be able, in his mind and in Ashley Judd's mind, for her to be able to go from that type of evening to sitting down next to Chris on the couch with Dominic to watch TV, that she's become this dispassionate and somewhat compartmentalized human being who can make these very, very kind of cold, necessary decisions. And that's what I always see, and that's what I always think of while Drucker is laying it out for her, just seeing the dread on her face as she's leaning against the wall. I think you only see like a quarter of her face because she's turning and kind of facing him, but just you see the dread of knowledge as she is weighing whether she's going to go back to that kind of life if she makes the wrong choice. And you know,
because that weight is apparent on her face. You know, like
it drives all of the decisions that she makes. She is just like Neil McCauley, because just like Neil McCauley, not just in pragmatism, not just in terms of being a survivor and this kind of self-taught real world attitude, just like Neil, she's not going back.
No.
Just like she's not going back to that type of prison that she lived in.
I'm so glad that you said that, because it's a great little tidbit, and we haven't dived into it too much, but there's an amazing story at the end of I think it's called The Bird Revelation, Dave Chappelle's most recent second half comedy special in Netflix, where he tells a story about Iceberg Slim's book, the final story in Iceberg Slim's book. And he says it's the Capitalist Manifesto. And it talks about, and I'll let you watch it, it's on Netflix, you can watch it up right now, anyone who's around the world. It talks about mileage on a hoe. And it talks about that everyone has their breaking point. And I think for Charlene, without going too much into detail, because I think it just echoed with me right now, is that Charlene's mileage for that life is, she's done with it. And I think she's planting the seeds with Azaria's character to get out of LA, to get into what she feels like might be a legitimate relationship. This guy's planting the seeds that I'll take you away, you and your son, etc. You can have a new life. You know, she just wants out. She, you know, and especially the proximity in LA, if it is true to that canon, that backstory canon of her turning tricks, it also is evident in her language. What are you selling? Like, what shit are you selling? Yeah. Like, this is someone who knows the game. It's maybe talk to someone on the street for in a transactional manner. And also, you know, she's got that cognitive distance, right? Neil talks to her that way in a sort of mean way. You can also intuit that's Neil. Clean up, go home. Like, Neil knows, you would guess, if she's turning tricks when Chris is in and out, he knows that too. Neil knows that she's turned tricks. So the way that he speaks to her in that disrespectful way is that. So, yeah, that's how I've always felt. I've always felt that. And I definitely think paired with her backstory and paired with Drucker's telling of a story, it really is it's a tale of their two lives intersecting. Like, she's been on the street, she's been around it, his whole life means this, and the last thing that she ever wanted was, she wanted that escape, and now the frustration and anger that's on her face at the end of this minute and that corresponds into the next scene is, I thought this guy was my escape route, this freaking dummy was going to help me get out of here, he's got some money, he was going to elevate me and my kid's life, I was going to have a route out of this life because Chris is spiraling out of control, and it's not that.
And this is a little off minute, and forgive me.
No, you don't have to say sorry, because like Neil McCauley, Travis, like Neil McCauley, we have the discipline, but we continually break it. We continually make decisions.
You know, as I'm sure you're learning, because I just never shut up, especially about this movie. But do you think she's really into Alan in any real capacity, or do you think that she's just kind of leapfrogging out of the life with Chris, and that he is someone that can be utilized to do that?
I've always thought it was the leapfrog. I've always thought she was going to get out, especially the way she tells Neil. Like, I love the ferocity of their encounter, that first encounter that they have, and you really see that she becomes one of the only people that actually legitimately stands up to Neil.
Stands up to him.
The way she says, "It's too late. I'm sick of it." Like, that just, that grinds into my brain. Like, you know, when everyone, you know, a line is powerful when it changes how you think about a line when someone says it. If someone says it's too late, or if anyone says I'm sick of it, any of those lines, I always just repeat. I'm like a parrot. I'm like, too late. I'm sick of it. Like, I can't help myself. It's like a tick. But that scene is, that's what I feel. Like, Marciano is a way out. that's what he is. And it's particularly, like, you think this woman, Ashley Judd, is not only, like, absolutely mesmerizingly beautiful. She's, you know, and the pairing of peak Kilmer and peak Judd is, like, it's almost like Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie. It's just too much. Like, stop. Joanne Woodward, Paul Newman, just explosion. Like, you can't help it, right? And so what I would say is, how many goddamn people are in LA? 18 million? Like, surely there's another man in LA if she really wanted, if that was the purpose of what she was seeking. She's seeking an out-of-town businessman who, in her mind, has no connection at all to criminality. That's why she's so frustrated with, like, oh, goddamn. Like, you have some bullshit that they can leverage. Like, you were the last. I thought you were some dick who was just a douchebag who had money. And so that's how I've always read that scene. There's no love between them. Hence, there's no love lost in this scene. Her revelation that he's an idiot is more of a disappointment in her own gauging of his personality. And to your point, or this is how I always read it, to your point, it's like, if she's turning 50 tricks a night, you think she doesn't know how to read people? So for her, it's like, I'm getting sloppy. You know, this is frustrating.
Which also kind of adds kind of a sad, unsettling layer to their hotel room tryst.
Oh, yes.
You know, but also, again, Jesus Christ, we're jumping into an entirely different minute. But the last thing I'll say about that minute is, well, two things. The reason I laughed when you said I'm sick of it is my girlfriend is also obsessed with Heat and has watched this movie so many times that whenever she's pissed at me, she will jokingly yell, I'm sick of it, just in that way, just to get at me. But I love Judd in that scene with Neil, you know, the clean up, go home scene when she's like, who is he? And she's like, it's Alan Marciano. And the way she describes him, it's the weirdest. No one would say this. He's a legit liquor wholesaler.
Yes.
But the reason I like that is she's saying what is important to her. Like, it would mean anything to Neil. He's a legit guy that makes money. He's an out for me. Mm-hmm. And I just love the psychology of that. And something that I don't know if Mann gets a lot of credit for are these tiny little lines like that that so cleanly and clearly display a character's psychology. He's a legit guy. He's a legit guy. No one would say that. You know, you get caught, you know, sleeping with someone else. Your first thing that you say when you describe them is not, look, this person's a legitimate businessman. Don't worry.
And how smart is she to know that he needs to know that? That's what I love about that scene. He needs to know that he's legitimate, because the first thing he thinks is, have you screwed me over by adding more heat into my situation by another crook? Because if they, if their in is him to me, then I have a choice to make about you. Like, we never get to that, but we all know that Neil is not going to muck around because he's more concerned about the relationship, that, you know, the damage and the fallout that might happen if he has to do anything to Charlene or force Chris's hand. It's in that moment he's a legitimate businessman, which completely kills Neil's line of inquiry on that, because he's like, then he flips it. He's like, okay, you need to work this out with Chris, because Chris is his most important ally.
And of course, what turns out is actually Neil's number one fear is true, that this guy is like half a wise guy that's got like a cigarette smuggling charge or something like that. And that somewhere down the line,
New Jersey. he's from Jersey.
Somewhere down the line, just like I said, the Heat's going to, they're going to absorb that flow of information. They're going to read him. They're going to brace him, and they're going to find out how they can lean on him to get one step closer to the McCauley crew, which is brings us back to our minute, which is where we are now. And since this is a podcast entirely about asides and conversational cul-de-sacs and things like that, I just want to say really quick, goddamn, I love these LA cop movies where everyone is somehow able to afford beachfront property.
Oh, I know.
Whether it's Chance as the Secret Service guy in To Live and Die in L.A. that is just living right on the beach, or William Peterson again in Manhunter in Florida, he's right on the beach, or even beautiful Martin Riggs, he might have an RV, but it's on the beach. I love that the LAPD in this movie has a safe house right on the boardwalk.
Yeah.
Right on the boardwalk.
Edie's house, this is the other thing. The great Manola Dargis, who's been on the show a few times, talked about Edie and Neil's interaction on her house, that beautiful ocean lit up skyline house that's on the rim of LA, like in the hills. And we talked about, you know, this is one time where we allow Michael Mann his fantasy to think that a graphic designer could afford that.
Oh my
house.
God, is living right above Sunset Plaza in that house. I know, it's one of the few things that bothers me about this movie is with this graphic designer that's having to work two jobs. One of which is at a bookstore. Mm-hmm. Where she's probably making minimum wage, is living above Sunset Plaza in this lovely little ramshackle house. But yeah, I love that. I don't know what the LAPD's budget is or was in 1995, but I did do some checking because I am insane.
Yes,
and this
I love
is the
this.
Place for it.
I love this.
That house was last sold in March of 1994. For $825,000.
Wow.
Which is what the LAPD would be laying out for this safe house that clearly is never used because there's like one couch. It is now, if they were to use it today, in today's dollars, it is currently on the market for $581,549.
Wow.
For a 3,000-square-foot, three-bed, four-bath bungalow. Beauty.
What
on...
On Venice Boulevard. What I was going to say to you is that $825,000 is around a four-bedroom house in a western sort of southern Sydney suburb right now. A four-bedroom house, double brick. Yeah, it's
okay.
but $5.1 million. Yeah. Wow.
I felt like I needed to contribute that. For no other reason than this is the insane home for that, and I just, you know, hope to dazzle you with my real estate acumen.
Oh, look at that, ladies and gentlemen! If you didn't already think that Travis's film criticism was good, he's got a backup career in knowledge of the retail market of LA property.
Actually, it was like literally the first Google entry for that address because I've been there before, so I just looked up the address.
It's funny later for the episode. There's a great double episode coming up. An Australian Academy Award nominated filmmaker and editor, Luke Doolan, who edited, probably most famously for the crowd who's listening to this, he edited the Australian movie Animal Kingdom. He came on the show to talk about the Ashley Judd, the infamous Ashley Judd gesture minute, which we can talk about. And it was really funny. He and another actor, Australian actor Henry Nixon, were in that episode, and they were in Venice when they were recording, because Luke currently lived in Venice, and Luke's like, I've been to that.
Yeah, you know, I've heard this episode. I think I've listened to this.
It was a little snippet, but he was like, I've lived there. I've put a snippet of it up, but the actual full episodes are going to be coming up pretty soon. So yeah, no, it's just so funny that it's like, it's probably the most expensive apartment because of that aspect. You know, you need that gorgeous crane shot that goes down to the street to get to Val. I think that's pretty much why we're here is, you know, they need that shot for that gorgeous, you know, approach and that two shot of those two guys in those spots.
I do love that shot, that right down Navy Street as the camera descends and like hooks around the corner from the balcony. I got to break into that house sometime. I just want to walk around inside
Just want to walk around.
You can't go into any houses. Huh?
You just want to walk around. You just need to take a photographer friend so you can take all, like, just snap, like, just stage a few of the heat shots. Do a beautiful one where you're looking at your lovely girlfriend, like, she's looking away from you, like Ashley Judd, and you're, like, Drucker, like, looking at it, like, you know, sort of get that perfect aspect there.
Yeah, I just want to stand on the balcony and do the cut gesture, and then she'll get really pissed and drive away because, you know, I'm committing a felony just to get a really cool picture to put on Twitter of me doing the cut gesture. Let's see. So anyway, just brief. Yeah. Crazy, wacky, weird aside. I just think it's hilarious that's where they actually have their safe house. And since you have other people that are going to be talking about the hand gesture minute, I don't know what you want to call it, but that minute, I don't want to step on anyone's toes, but what I really think is fascinating about Charlene and Charlene's psychology is everyone else in the film, as we've said, gets put into a position where they have to make the ultimate capital E existential choice for themselves in this film, that everyone that makes that choice does so out of self-interest. They are doing, even if it ends up being the wrong thing, as in the case of like Macaulay, they're doing it because they think it is in their self-interest. They think it is the right choice to make for them. Mm-hmm. And what I think about, what I think is interesting about Charlene, and you know, spoilers for the one insane person that's listening to this podcast that hasn't seen Heat, is that she actively is the only character, she's the only character that actively knowingly makes the choice she know will be wrong for her and wrong for Dominic. And I just find that that is also, you know, talk about a script, Michael Mann being a writer that can surprise you with his characterizations. That is one of the left hooks that this movie throws that I did not see coming, either when I was like a 13-year-old kid that had no idea what he was watching, but even, you know, when I watched it as an adult, it's an amazing moment, and it's an amazing human moment where you think she's gonna make one choice, and all Val Kilmer has to do is smile that pretty smile, and she melts and makes the wrong choice and knows that she's making the wrong choice. And that is such, especially from such a pragmatist like her, and the very serious survivor, the matter of fact, black and white, risk versus reward survivor that we've seen up to this point, that is just such a monumental and devastating and very real and human moment. And I wanted to blather on about that for
you totally, 3 minutes. You're allowed to.
It's an amazing surprise of characterization.
It's an amazing surprise. And also I think there's a gap in air where there's an exchange of looks prior to the gesture. And it's really powerful. I'm looking forward to you guys listening to the episode when it comes up. And one of the things I would say about it that I've thought more on it since recording that episode, because it was recorded with Luke some time ago, is how he looks. So he looks beaten up. Like, he looks like Chris, but he almost is unrecognizable.
His face is really tight, is pinched down towards his collarbone.
Down, and he looks a bit swollen and red.
Yeah.
And he smiles up at her, and she appraises him. And it's the emotions that she's able to convey.
Mm.
There's like a deep pity and empathy. And you watch her make the decision that she's going to have that choice. She's going to do something that is ultimately selfless, and it's a gamble. The risk versus reward in that situation is something that Chris would gamble on. It's not a Charlene move. It's a Chris move. But her empathy in that moment is so powerful. And that's like, there's moments in this movie that just get to me. It sounds cliche, but it's like they literally get me every time. And that exchange, you guys will get to hear it, of which you guys would have already heard in episode 123. So only two episodes ago, it's so funny that this minute is now coming back up. Bilge Ibiri called that, if all of cinema was thrown into the ocean and we knew nothing about it, that you could teach people the power of cinema with that scene alone, not just that minute, that scene. He's like, and he's much more lofty in his aspirations, but I think he's right. It's like conveying the editing, the emotional, you know, the mounting emotional pressure, the pressure of the people that are inside, like the entire construction of that scene from beginning to end, as the car comes down the street, as you see Drucker, as you see the cops, as you see Charlene directed to go out there, as you see their exchange, and you understand the context of everything that's going to happen between them. It's so incredibly powerful, and it's just a moment, and there's no words, not a single thing. You could make it a silent film and just have the music, and it's just perfect.
They're empathy machines. That's what these movies are. That scene is.
That is it. And that's what it is. And this is what the brilliance I allow the lack of discipline on this show is. Once we scrutinize the minute, you have to talk. That's one wonderful thing, is that they do operate as these lovely vignettes. But then what I think sort of exponentially makes them more powerful is how they have underpinnings and echoes in other minutes, like how things are happening across the film. Even the same words are said to certain characters, and the same bargains that are being being delivered. It's like exactly as you intimated at the beginning of the episode. It's like these are just choices after choices that are just being laid out for people to make, and you're desperate for them to make the right choice, but it's not easy to see what the right choice is, for especially in the second half of this movie. It's like you're not easy to see what the right choice is. It's, and sometimes the choice you want them to make isn't the right choice. It's not the survival, it's for the drama. And so we have to be on their side to watch them make these people make the wrong choice.
And that's the thing too, when you, God, we're just so not on our minute anymore. But yeah, when you do watch that scene, I don't feel like you're ever mad at her, even though you're like, look, you're Dominic's mother. You can't do this to this kid. You're going down as an accessory, because we all know, you know, Chris probably didn't have his name on the cars or the property. Everything was probably laundered through Charlene, or, you know, everything has her name on it. So she's going to lose everything, bare minimum. She's losing everything if she doesn't go to jail, which she probably will. Dominic probably will be institutionalized. He will go through the system. He's probably everything that Drucker said is probably going to come true. But in that moment, when she has that almost motherly, tender smile of looking at him once he smiles, and that look that just says, yeah, he's an idiot, but he's my idiot.
Yes. Yes.
Who else? No one else in this world is going to look after Chris Shehurlis besides me. And even though the same should be said of Dominic, there is just that wonderfully human moment of just not being able to help yourself, and to talk about how that ties into other things, as you just said, and I'm going to totally use this to cheat and jump to my favorite minute. It's very similar to McCully in the tunnel when he's broken the rules for the first time, or his rules for the first time in his life. And that kind of gleeful, emotional nihilism of realizing he's out there on the edge breaking rules, and that's what got him Edie. So in his mind, that's going to work against Wangro. And just this weird – I'm really fascinated by the weird parallels between McCully and Charlene, and how they both are these very controlled, orderly pragmatists is the word I keep using, who – their downfall is pretty much engendered by the fact that they discover this excess of humanity within themselves that they were no longer aware of, or they had sanded down and kept tamped down. And at the most crucial, elevated moment of their lives is when they let that humanity overwhelm them. And it is both what makes them human, but it's also, as we're going to see, probably with Charlene, definitely with McCully, it's the thing that destroys them.
Yes.
Destroys them both. And just, yeah, and how all of their decisions are interrelated into this just distribution of fates throughout the film, and how these two characters have such sense, as much as we can talk about, McCully and Hannah being similar. I loved in Jordan Harper's episode, he talked about how actually there's a lot of similarities between McCully and Wangro.
Yes.
I do think that in a lot of ways, Charlene is a shadow character of McCully. And so many of the moves that she makes are moves that McCully would make in that position. And again, the thing that undoes them both is just this moment where they cannot help but embrace this almost gleeful emotional core that they've neglected or ignored, and then once they do, you know, they lose all grip on any type of any realistic chance of survival. I just think it's amazing.
Emotional myopia, like in those moments that you're talking about, right? And
boy, we are getting deep here tonight.
Very deep. And what I would say is for everyone, what has been a huge surprise on this podcast, it hasn't been a surprise that this movie is exceptional. It hasn't been a surprise to me that the great guests that I speak to can talk at length about the power of the individual minute that we're talking about, but then as a portal to discuss broader themes of the movie or the genre or the filmmakers or the performers. But it's when I began this project, I always thought that people would want to talk about the conversation, and I always thought that people would want to talk about the heist. And perhaps I always thought that people were going to talk about some of the big moments, like with Wangro, the Wangro death, and then the airport. But a couple of moments, like three moments in this movie that have like completely surprised me that people are so passionate to talk about are the interactions between Donald Breeden and Lillian when she goes to him after after his first day at work.
That hurts my heart.
The Charlene Chehalis gesture moment, which people have elevated, as you have, as like one of the most powerful moments in the film. And that tunnel scene. That tunnel scene is the most valuable piece. If we're talking about real estate values, that tunnel scene's value, my projected value was only $825,000, but it's now like a $5.1 million minute of this movie. And very fortunately, Matt Zolozites, the editor of RogerEbert.com, has spoken at length about that minute.
So jealous. So jealous of him. And yet so excited.
I'm just teasing that it is coming in the future. I was very pleased that he was someone I was hunting down to be a part of this project since its inception. And so don't worry, there's a lot more that has been said about that minute and that this movie that's waiting for you on the horizon.
And aside from literally De Niro or Mann, I don't know if I could think of a better non-Heat cast and crew person to talk about what is for me the apex moment, the capital M moment of Heat, which is Nate's weirdly touching farewell to Macaulay, and then that just that. That almost, am I going to do this? Holy shit, I'm going to do this.
Watching
I'm going to live like
watching
this.
Watching him know what emotions are in his face.
This is how real people live.
Yes.
Yeah, these are the kind of decisions real humans make, and I'm going to make one. Hey, it got me Edie. It convinced her to come away with me on that beautiful Malachy Hill. I'm just going to do it again, and I'm going to get Wangro, and we're going to get out of here, and like, it's going to end well for me.
Can I just say that whatever county owns that hill, if it's not called Malachy Hill, you're really doing yourself a disservice.
They've blown it. There's got to be some sort of weird city ordinance or county ordinance that any picture you take from that hill, any selfie, any Instagram post, it always has to have the little bits of grass and weeds and stuff like that fanning in the foreground, because if you don't do that, then it's not Malachy. You got to have the grass, and then, you know, maybe make an Instagram story where you whisper a voiceover of your inner monologue.
No, you can't be your own voiceover. You've got to get your cousin, who sort of sounds like you, to be your inner voice monologue.
But isn't you?
Yeah. Because then you're like, that's Adrian Brody, isn't it? That's it. You know, that's not this guy that I'm looking at. Anyway, so that's a little Malik digressions on this show. The digressions
I'm very proud of how digressive we're getting here, and I'm very proud of myself that I totally got to cheat and steal a little bit of that minute, and make it mine.
It's impossible on this show, and that's why I said the discipline is that we talk about the minute, but I think it's a pathway to talk about so many different things, and I think that's how people have found entryways into the movie if there haven't been people like you or I who've loved it. It's that sometimes there's something that's going on. You know, I've talked to a great writer for RogerEbert.com, Brendan Hodges, a Chicago critic who, you know, talked about he was talking about the allegories to Antonioni, and we just talked about Malick, but there's also, you know, moments that feel very Lynchian, you know, Lynch making Mulholland and other LA-based content that's like, you know, that feels like it's quintessentially about the city. And there's so many other filmmakers and styles and expressions of little things that you see where the film doesn't overplay its influences, but is happy to interact with them. You know, it's just like a dialogue between different filmmakers from the same sort of context that have that same weird vision of like, this is how I'm going to project my LA. And it might feel a little bit post-apocalyptic, or it might feel like it's a bit of a dream, or it might feel like it's this beautiful artifice and we need this glorious romantic moment. But it's all that collision of those things that makes this movie the pinnacle, the apex LA movie.
It is. I mean, it's cliche to say, I guess, at this point, but Heat is, it is the LA movie. What was it? It's like 93 different locations in Los Angeles, which was more than any other movie in history at the time, and maybe still is. But yeah, it is. it is just this kaleidoscopic collage of this city and the way it unites all of these disparate threads of this city into a whole. Here comes the pretentious writer part. Just as it unites all of these characters and their cascading fates into this one knot, K-N-O-T, of a story, it is. It's the best LA movie ever made. Well, okay. Neck and neck with Point Break.
I was waiting for which neck and neck. Is it a serious neck and neck, or is it that?
I can't not mention Point Break, which is probably...
It's the best looking LA movie that's ever been made, undeniable.
I hope it becomes immortal, whatever happens with human civilization. It needs to be right there with the cave paintings.
Patrick Swayze is as rugged as a cave painting in that movie, let me tell you. He's a beautiful man. And it's just a travesty that they remade Point Break unabashedly and turned it into
this huge franchise.
And all the fans of said franchise that we're not going to even mention on this show just never even acknowledged that the first movie, which they claim is great, is a just flagrant ripoff of Point Break. Can we all just stop for a second?
Can I just say how nearly moved to tears I am right now that I have somehow managed to... not only cheat and jump to my favorite minute of Heat, but that I was able to work in a Point Break digression into this episode, because Point Break really is. There's no better artistic concoction, I think, in the sum totality of human history. We have not topped Point Break. We just haven't, and we won't.
There might be one moment that does, and it's Nick Frost in Hot Fuzz watching Point Break. That might be the that meta moment of watching an Edgar Wright movie, loving on and appraising Point Break, and then Nick Frost doing the little like fake gun toting shooting in the air moment in Hot Fuzz. It's pretty close. It's close.
You know,
just
Blake,
for a fleeting moment.
Blake, you're talking to a man who literally tears up when Bodhi says, "Yo, Johnny, I'll see you in the next life," after they jump out of an airplane together in Point Break. So you're not going to convince me that there's anything great better. But the second greatest film of all time, the second greatest LA film of all time, is Heat. It is amazing. And I know we're pushing time here. I do just want to throw out really quick, if we haven't made it clear enough, what a quietly powerful secret weapon Ashley Judd is in Heat. And she does so very much with not a whole lot of screen time for a film that is this long. She's really not in the movie all that much. And yet every single time she gets on the screen, it is indelible. And the intelligence of her performance, like her eyes are always working. I jump to another minute really quick, and this is such a weird bit of personal minutia, but that bit when Macaulay tells her to clean up, go home, you know, I'll pay your way out if I have to, if it doesn't work with Chris. The weird little confused back and forth that she does with her eyes, where she's like, okay. And you already see her go accepting this as the new reality. Okay, I guess that's what I'm going to do. The reward is worth the risk of this. I'll do this. You see her doing this moral and existential calculus in her head right then and there. And she does it in every single goddamn scene we see her in. She's doing that. And it is just the fact that she is able to keep that from ever being one note, that she ever keeps that from being – it is never, ever not – empathetic and not human and not understandable, as much as if you saw her character on the nightly news, you would hate her for the decisions you hear that she's made. But when you watch it in this film, you might disagree with the choices she makes, but you never hate her for them.
And I think it was only the revelations of last year around, you know, sorry to get to talking about nightly news, but the revelations around the silencing of her career from formerly powerful Hollywood individuals now makes total sense as to many times that I've watched this film in my life, I've always thought, and it's not to say that the Academy Awards are necessarily, and I think we can all argue, as like the perfect encapsulation of prestige for Hollywood, because there's always arguably films that are lost from that list or not voted for, etc., especially previous iterations of the Academy. But to think that someone as powerful, with movie star charisma, with in a huge masculine movie that makes such an indelible impact at the peak of her career, doesn't get recognition for this performance, and then therefore doesn't use this as a catapult, as a lot of the actors who've worked alongside Michael Mann into other huge leading roles in other movies, it just seems like lunacy. Like, you just go, where did this amazing performer disappear off the face of the earth to? And you're now sort of starting to see her emerge back in popular consciousness, and filmmakers actively pursuing her to be in their films again, because of, you know, found out all of the, you know, the how she was tarnished, as far as people reputationally tarnished by these assholes in the industry. But it's like, I've always wondered that huge gap. It's like the same tragedy you feel about like someone not being able to play a sport, you know, she's just taken off the field, taken out of rotation, and she's like a star. She should have been one of the greats.
And it really is. Yes, it is 1,000% tragic, not just because we did not get more amazing performances to enjoy.
No.
Just what happened to her is just awful in general.
Yes.
And enraging. But yeah, it is. She is one of those actresses, not actresses, just performers in general. One of those performers that is just so perfect and so in tune with their character and so intelligent and so just emotionally galvanizing that when you don't see them for a long time, it is mind-boggling, and especially when you consider this was like her third movie. She had done some TV, and you know, before this movie, like, had a deleted scene in Natural Born Killers and like had the role of like paint store owner's wife was the title of her first movie role, just like 2 years before Heat. And To you know, I think it's both a tribute to her extraordinary talent, but also Mann's incredible eye for actors and for performers, that, you know, he could trust to anchor this maybe small in screen time but massively important anchor of a character and a performance, that he would be willing to hinge that on someone relatively untested.
Yes.
I think speaks a lot about her talent, and he was clearly right, because, you know, here we are talking endlessly in between Jags on Point Break. We were talking about just what an amazing, brilliant performance she gives, whether it is when she is being verbal and she's sick of it, or she, you know, is teaching Dominic how to pronounce avocado, or whether or not she is literally choosing to destroy her son's life. So her murderous, alcoholic,
degenerate
gambler, yep, husband can drive off with a couple million in the back of his car to go do whatever, probably like die 6 months from now, having blown it all in Vegas. Oh my God. Yeah. We're gonna have to do like a whole other hour where we just talk about like just how great she is. Cause I don't think we've hit that enough now, I'm realizing. But she's just so amazing. And yeah, I think she is kind of a quiet MVP in Heat that doesn't get talked about as much, because, you know, this is the movie that is the cataclysmic encounter and the cataclysmic sit down between De Niro and Pacino. But Jesus Christ, Ashley Judd just gives them no quarter in this movie at all. She is, and as you said, she is literally the only person that you know, aside from Pacino, you know, obviously, she's the only character in the movie of all these heavies and all these badasses and hard asses and hard cases. She's the only one that stands toe to toe with Neil McCauley, and
it's an intimidating thing, yeah. And he doesn't back down, and knows how to stand firm.
Yeah, and even the flicker in his eye when she stands up to him, like, who else does that? Who else gets his attention like that? And apologize for the squeaking, my dog's attacking a toy. but yeah, it just I cannot say, obviously, I cannot say enough about the strength of her performance. And I it is one of my favorite things when I do revisit this film a million times over is how, not that this is a boring film by any means, but how every scene with her in it comes alive in a very different way than the remaining 155 minutes that she's not in. That there is just... there is just a tone and a feel and a life that is in this in all of her scenes that I just adore.
Well, I think you've nearly made it. I think you've nearly cracked the 105. I think the hour and 5 minutes. I think you've nearly cracked it, Travis.
Oh well, hell, I've got one more thing then I can throw out. does anyone ever notice, like, Charlene Shaherless is a really weird name and a really hard name to say, and yes. I have to try really hard not to mess it up.
Yes.
I feel like Jeff Bridges with peanut butter in my mouth whenever I try to say it. But like Charlene Shaherless, that's just a weird car crash of vowels and consonants that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And for the real Heat fan, for the discerning Heat fan, if they're curious, Shaherless with that spelling, that insane spelling, it is the 8,293,955th most common surname on the planet. Currently, only 4 people in the world are known to have that surname. They all live in Israel. And what does this have to do with Heat, and why did Michael Mann choose this name then for those characters, you might be asking? And my answer would be, I don't have a fucking clue. I really don't. I just wanted everyone to know how seriously I took our fandom, that I looked that up for us all. I looked it up for all of us so we could finally know why
4 people currently in the world have that surname.
All in Israel.
All in Israel.
I don't know what the significance of that. And there's only 4. But yeah, in case anyone was wondering why Kilmer and Judd had to have that wacky name that you always skip over and try not to say because you don't want to embarrass yourself, because I don't know about anybody else, I have a harder time pronouncing Charlene Shaherless than Dominic Shaherless has pronouncing avocado. Like, I have to really stop avocado. And like, mentally tiptoe around the word. But yeah, weird name, nothing to do with anything. But again, this is just like the real estate information about Drucker's
this
Steakhouse.
This is essential.
Fitness.
I just want to qualify.
No other
this is,
place.
There's no other place for us to have this dialogue, and that's important.
There's no other place I can go, Blake, to give to give this shit that's rattling around in my head. And if you don't take it from me, I'm gonna be like James Dean at the end of East of Eden when his dad won't take the money, and I'm gonna lose it. And so I gotta take this and I gotta give it to somebody.
I don't know where else to go. You're taking it for us. You're bringing it to us, and we will disseminate it as part of One Heat Minute, and people will know more. And people will. I guarantee you. Please always ask at the end of every show. Mail at One Heat Minute. Tell me if you are now happy that you know about Charlene Shaherless and the fact that there are only 4 Shahelises in the world. I need you to tell me, because I these are things that I wonder as well. Like, it's such a unique name. Names are so important. Names are so important. People talk about it with different people having obsessive cues and tweaks with certain names. Soderbergh being one that's fun with names of characters. And here, Michael Mann obsessively with Shaherless. Just such a random name. And a lyrical quality. Chirito, yeah. Trejo, Shaherless, and Macaulay, sure. You know, maybe, you know, I wouldn't put it past him to have been a real life associate of the original criminal Neil Macaulay, and he's just taken that name as well. Maybe it was some prominent crook.
Maybe one of the 4 people on planet Earth with the name Shaherless is like the great grandkid of the original Macaulay gang or something like that. But yeah, I love it. Charlene Sherlis, the most insanely, unrealistically alliterative name in the Michael Mann canon. And yes, I am glad that I know it now. And every time I watch the film from here on out, I'm not going to be thinking, oh, what an amazing performance. Oh, my God, look at Judd's eyes. Look how she is conveying so much pain and history and struggle in this moment. I'm going to be sitting there thinking, there's like four other dudes on planet Earth with that last name.
And thank you for thank you for that unnecessary information that is now going to be a permanent subtitle etched into my eyes when I see her performance in this movie.
I am so happy I have been able to time capsule this ludicrous and pointless minutia that I've been able to wedge it into the dirt of one heat minute, where it's just going to live on in forever. Although I highly doubt anyone is going to have gotten this far in the podcast to listen to me.
They will.
Continue.
Our listeners, jump. Travis, they will. This is a dedicated lot. You did have one question I'm going to prompt you just so you can really kick it home. Okay. What was your question you wanted to ask me?
Well, also because I got to smoke Lynch now. I got to break the record. I'm like the guy at the end of Michael Mann's Jericho Mile. I'm going to win. I got to win this. I was curious. And I don't, like, as I've said, I'm only to about like into the 30 or 40 minute mark of the podcast itself. I've jumped ahead to a bunch of episodes that have involved Charlene, and I've listened to episodes of people that I know. But I have not listened to every episode yet. And I did not know if this was mentioned elsewhere. I am curious, what is Blake's favorite one heat minute?
So I think we may have answered it at some point, but it's good for a current top up. My thing was, what surprised me is that minutes have emerged up the ladder. So I'll tell you what my number one is, but a minute that like just destroys me every time is the Don Breeden-Lillian minute. Like that has elevated itself. Like we talked about some of the more iconic minutes, you know, your personal favorite, Travis, in the tunnel, the gesture with Charlene, obviously the conversation, obviously some minutes in the heist, you know, particularly when Chris changes the magazine, you know, the reveal minute, like what are they looking at? We just got made, you know, like that, you know, there's those moments or the, you know, the guy who, bangs the inside of the surveillance van, and then Neil and Pacino are looking at each other through infrared or infrablue. Michael Mann can't use infrared; he needs an infrablue camera. So there's those minutes which have all been there, but the Lillian and Breeden minute, as like we talked about, a microcosm, a decision, an encounter, and sort of making decisions about how you're going to affect the outcome of the rest of your life. That minute has elevated significantly, but the minute that I can't ever shake and the minute that continues to impact me as an adult the way that everything does is I can't get past the final minute of this film. Just the unquantifiable weight of 165 minutes of screen time, and you said it perfectly before, this knot, K-N-O-T, this knot of these intersecting stories and everything that was seen in this epic and the staging and then just the way that Neil espouses his own sort of philosophy and the way that Vincent reacts to it and the way that the score swells and the entire and the minutiae of talking about the glory of a performance that says nothing. I think that final minute of Pacino's performance as he's faces rippling with the conflicting emotions of that situation. That is the moment that in amongst 165 minutes that get me every time, that moment is the moment that gets me every single time. The weight of this entire film, I think, lands in Pacino's face, and I think he does it justice. So right now and probably forever, the moment that we're mounting towards, the very last moment of this movie, is still my absolute favorite. But there's so many more moments that are swirling about like a lottery, like, you know, like just like you could pick a countless number of other moments. And then there's just one that's just sitting above it. And largely it's influenced by the collective weight of all those other minutes just landing into that. Because I think, you know, for you and I who write about films a lot, it's like, you know, beginnings of films, endings of films, this special final moments are just so like they come with such power. Like a movie that can end like with just a powerful and ambivalent moment, they don't come around that often. Like the one that I think a lot of people talk about most recently is, say, like Moonlight. The ending of Moonlight is staggering. It's absolutely staggering. And to end with such power and with just underplaying what everyone wants to happen, underplaying it and just playing with such perfection, just a deft control, and then finishing the movie. It's, yeah, I just think they come around rarely. And when they happen, you're like, Jesus, that is powerful. Like, and I think that's why I have to say it's my favorite.
Well, man did say, at a recent Q&A for the 4K release of the film, and I'm sure he said it elsewhere, he did enter into the Heat screenplay by writing the ending first.
Yes.
And as he said, he reverse engineered the entirety of the film, moving backwards from that moment where these two men, the only two men like each other in the whole world, you know, are with each other when one of them dies, and that everything else literally was birthed like from Zeus's forehead right out of that moment. And that's why I think this film is so thematically powerful, and that why it holds up to the scrutiny of one Heat minute is literally every minute is that ending is like the Big Bang.
Yes.
And every minute that comes out of that, just like how we all have a little bit of star stuff in us from the initial Big Bang, every minute of this film contains particles and elements and little bits of business from that final sequence. It's blown throughout the entire film. And that is why I think this is such a thematically cohesive story and portrait of these characters, is because everything, every single thing of this, every little strand of this insanely dense tapestry, whether it's Wayne Grow or Van Zandt or Dominic Shaherless or the TV guy that sees the 211 at the beginning of the film with his TV in his cart and he hears Slick, all of these characters, big and small, they are all intrinsically tied to that one minute where these two men recognize one another and recognize that they are alone outside of one another, and that they are what they're after. And that moment of recognition right before we cut to black, every scene just is has particles of that in it. And that's why Heat is a masterpiece. And that's why, again, it holds up to literally insane people sitting around and spending an hour talking about a 60-second. Well, I told you what I was going to do. But to sit around and just chat about these 60-second slivers, it's because it all comes from that final scene, that perfect moment of cinema that we are very lucky to have. And That is the film. That scene is the film.
Well, that is the end of this episode of One Heat Minute, the 125th episode of One Heat Minute. This has been my amazing guest, Travis Woods. Travis, thank you so much for being part of this show. And I knew that even before we started recording, in our exchanges in email and on Twitter, that this was going to be phenomenal. So I just want to say a huge thank you for your participation. It's been incredible. Travis is at A Heart of Gould on Twitter. You can find he's got a little Contently link up on his Twitter profile, so you can see all of his stuff from Bright Wall Dark Room, a great publication, and his new Cinephilia and Beyond gig, so you'll see him contributing there. Mate, this has been outstanding. Two all-time moments, finding out the property values, and also finding out that there are only four Shaheelises in the world that we understand.
With that spelling. Full disclosure, there are other Shaheelises, just different spellings.
Full with that spelling. But thank you so much for being a part of 1-8 Minute. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
Mr. Garth Franklin, as always, thank you for our web design. Paul Davies, thank you for our awesome theme. And guys, thank you so much for being a part of One Heat Minute. And we'll catch you in another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner, unless, you know, you decide to make a decision that sends your son off to a gladiator academy in Chino. but we'll catch you in another episode soon. See you guys.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.